It's time once again for the Jesus Factor here on the Eagle Radio Network. Stand by. We've got a great update on our travels and information about the Middle East, and even a few comments about the earlier broadcast. We look forward to sharing those with you. Well, yes, sir. This is Scott Stevens welcoming you all to the Jesus Factor here on a rainy Sunday afternoon in beautiful East Hampton, Connecticut. We've had an interesting couple of weeks. We had a little bit of a vacation from our day-to-day worldly job that we do enjoy, but don't mind having a period of time away from it. It was an interesting trip. The road back was fraught with heavy snow and a number of events that were less than pleasing to the flesh, but in the end, our prayers were answered and we did arrive home on Thursday night. It was actually Friday morning by the time we got in, and I think probably the only thing that went awry on the return trip was my having to relieve myself very near New York City on Route 287, which some of you may know. And it's a major highway that leads over the Tappan Zee Bridge, which crosses the Hudson River. And it's a good way to avoid going through New York City and getting into Connecticut at about the furthest southern point in which there is access. And my GPS failed. I've had the little newbie for 12 years, and I gave it a decent burial in a garbage can beside the road. And as we went forth, I did stop right by New York City and got off the highway and immediately was lost as far as finding my way back to it. You know, in that part of the country, interstate highways almost exclusively dump out into other four-lane highways. And turning around on one of those is somewhat complicated. You have to find a exit that doesn't tie into another four-lane highway, hopefully sometime before you end up in Manhattan. And other than that, everything went very well. That was, for me, a very perplexing situation. It snowed. At that point, I think the storm was at just about its most aggressive point. And thankfully, Gail was able to discern an on-ramp that had a loop and got us back onto the highway. We'll be buying another GPS before we go out on the road. You know, you become dependent on some of this technology. And, boy, that was a good segue into the technology of, say, in broadcaster and radio stations. We all know, by the end of today's series of broadcasts, that I made some minor adjustments to my brother Paul's system there in South Carolina. And Paul has an interesting setup there, one that allows him to patch in calls from Skype. And there's a gizmo, it's an electronic program called a virtual cable, that allows you to run different audio sources into your broadcast system. And these virtual cables, each time I have attempted to use them on my machine, they've confused me so completely that I haven't ever kept them around for very long. And so there's really no further explanation for our endeavors over in South Carolina to try and get some of Paul's ancillary equipment up and running. He has a nice little radio card in his computer that would allow him to get a bit more range on the FM side so he could get a broadcast signal out to the local community a little bit more effectively. And my efforts there were directed to getting that system up and running. It seems that in the end that he intends to send that out to Texas to see whether or not we can at least make use of it elsewhere. In his system, it just doesn't seem to be working as it should. And whether it's the hardware or whether it's the way it's set up there, no one apparently can tell. I was blessed to be able to finally get our system here set up so that Gail was able to get online and share in the broadcast earlier today. So, the Hour of Truth, it's always good to have a few voices there on the Hour of Truth, the various perspectives of people as they experience the walk in Christ. And a lot of interesting services out there this morning, staying with the theme of loneliness and meekness, the idea of esteeming each other better than ourselves from Philippians chapter 2, verse 3. And this is an essential element of agape love. And the mindset allows us to receive the love of God and to demonstrate that love of God to others in sharing the gospel, sometimes with words and at other times with consideration for others, particularly those that are yet in darkness and have not received Jesus as their Lord and Savior, requiring more patience and more time, as we at an earlier time had need of. None of us have been perfect in love, as the Father is perfect, but those that are His over the years have continued to minister His love. Even the truth, even those that, excuse me, even in times where people have turned from the gospel and fallen away from the truth or fallen short in their walk with the Lord, our Father has continued to love them, and His ministers have stood in patience for their sake. David was an example shared this morning of God's perfect love and His forgiveness of sin, as it is recounted in Psalm 51. Both for us and for David, only the love of God makes us acceptable. The sacrifice of Jesus Christ allows us to stand perfectly forgiven before the Lord, our faith in that sacrifice being the essential element that we bring to the table, rather than faith in our own abilities or our own works. Faith in His perfect plan for us and for this world, which will ultimately bow the knee to Him.
In the morning, slaving for bread, sir, so that every mouth can be fed. Oh, me Israelite, sir. Get up in the morning, slaving for bread, sir, so that every mouth can be fed.
Oh, me Israelite.
Wipe on my kids, up on the leaving.
Well, yes, sir, the Israel Update song here on the Jesus Factor coming to you on the Eagle Radio Network. We have a number of things going on over there in the Middle East, things that are not on the front pages of the news. One of the things we've spoken of at length here on the Jesus Factor is that there will be a continuing consolidation of jihadist forces throughout the Middle East. And we spoke a couple of weeks ago when we were on the road of a series of events going on in Iraq. They are several weeks into a major offensive being joined by the United States and Iran, hoping to cut al-Qaeda down. Their mission is to foil al-Qaeda's drive to spread its first independent state in the Middle East across the Iraq-Syrian frontier. Its Iraqi and Syrian branches, ISIS and the Nusra Front, have declared a holy war to this end under their commanders Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and Abu Muhammad al-Golani. These people, should they establish a quasi-state in the area, will have taken the first step toward consolidating jihadist radicals in their continuing fight against Israel and against the United States, her most faithful ally. Of course, the United States, being aligned with Iran in this particular series of battles to thwart al-Qaeda, may end up turning to Israel's good. To counter al-Qaeda's superiority in speed and surprise, the U.S. has sent the Iraqi army Hellfire surface-to-air missiles. They're already in use against al-Qaeda camps on the Syrian border. Next, Washington is sending out small, long-endurance, unmanned aerial scan eagles. These drones are best suited to combat in Anbar's deep wadis and the Halafite thickets lining the Euphrates River. In this topsy-turvy scenario, Washington and Tehran share another surprising motive: to save the Assad regime in Damascus from al-Qaeda's long arms. It's been a while since we've spoken here of all of the various factions fighting in the Middle East. And, of course, Syria has a number of them battling for supremacy, political supremacy there. And there aren't a lot of sides in that conflict that would be good for the United States to be joined with. It's been one of the problems our political people have faced in seeking to find a way to ameliorate or end the conflict that's been going on, the civil war there in Syria. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov noted approvingly on the 26th of December that attitudes are changing in Western countries. They are becoming more realistic in their approach toward the Syrian crisis. The threat of terrorism in Syria, of jihadists coming to power, of creating a caliphate with extremist laws, these are the main problems. And of course, my encoder has disconnected. Like we're back up. I believe we're back online here on the Jesus Factor. Hopefully we've got it. It looks like the encoder has re-engaged. I do apologize for that. Folks, we've never encountered that issue before. And it seems we're locked in right now. And so I do apologize for any inconvenience the listeners went through. We're talking about the conflict going on in Iraq. We have a strange set of bedfellows aligning against Al-Qaeda in Iraq with the United States, Iran, and some of Iraqi's forces. And all of this, of course, the concern over there is that these jihadists are seeking to establish a state, a caliphate, from which they would conduct their business and certainly gather to themselves an ever-increasing number of factions that would be arrayed against Israel and the United States. Since the Syrian chemical issue was addressed in September, sort of, Russian-Iranian-American collaboration is going strong. The U.S. joint Iranian war on Al-Qaeda is strengthening Tehran's grip on Iraq as well as Syria. It gives Russian President Vladimir Putin hope for keeping Al-Qaeda away from the Winter Olympics at Sochi, an ever-present menace as a female suicide bomber, a Dagestan national, demonstrated on Sunday, December 29th, by blowing up the railway station at the southern Russian city of Volgograd, killing up to a score of people. And once again, we apologize for that encoder glitch, something that we have not encountered in the past. The other incentive for U.S. President Barack Obama is the hope of transposing his collaboration with Tehran and Moscow to improve U.S. chances of a reasonable accommodation in the Afghanistan arena. So, a lot of different factions in operation over there. Now, what is going on, of course, you've heard the name Fallujah, most of you who had listened to broadcasts during the time that American forces were fighting in Iraq. The Al-Qaeda factions over in Iraq are presently battling for the city of Fallujah. And Al-Qaeda's most significant victory in the Syrian war was achieved this last week in the Iraqi arena. Its Iraq and Syrian branch, ISIS, is the name of one of them. Al-Nusra is the one that is active in Syria. And under the command of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, resoundingly defeated the Iraqi army, which 2 weeks ago launched a major offensive to relieve the country of the jihadist grip. Baghdadi's troops were able to throw back the Iraqi army's 7th and 1st Divisions and keep going to capture large sections of Ramadi and Fallujah, the key Sunni cities of western and central Iraq. Again, you will remember these cities being central in the United States' effort to dominate the Iraqi landscape when we were involved in the invasion of that country. This victory enabled ISIS to forge a territorial chain of control stretching from Ramadi, that is, in central Iraq, 110 kilometers west of Baghdad, all the way to the northern Syrian town of Al-Raqqa, 160 kilometers from Aleppo. Aleppo is in Syria and is another stronghold of Al-Qaeda. Now, you see these conflicts beginning to take on dimensions outside of the current national boundaries of the various countries. This is to be expected as more and more jihadists come against the United States and her ally Israel. And as the United States continues to send either mixed or signals worse still that suggest our arrangements with Israel have faltered or are continuing to falter at an even greater degree, as those signals continue to get across to the jihadists and the Muslim factions that are against the United States and Israel, they will continue to coalesce around the stronger elements of these jihadist groups, Al-Qaeda being one of the most significant. Military sources report that Al-Qaeda owes much of the victory to the decision of the Sunni tribes of western Iraq to join and spearhead its counterattack on Iraqi forces. After smashing whole Iraqi units in the two cities, these tribal militias opened the door for the ISIS jihadists to march in. You see, the Arab people love strong men. They gravitate under the spirit that joined them together so many centuries ago under Nebuchadnezzar. That same spirit is one, the spirit of the strong man, that the jihadist forces will cleave to. The strongest force in the area is typically the one that the militias will agree with. And this is not complicated, it's simply a matter of survival. And if the snowballing effect of these jihadist forces, Al-Qaeda in particular, continue to accomplish their purposes in the various countries in the Middle East and transcend these national boundaries, those boundaries will continue to blur, and their goal of establishing a caliphate that would allow them a geographic center may be accomplished in the not-too-distant future. Ironically, the tribal militias backing Al-Qaeda are the same awakening groups which the U.S. Army sustained and armed for the battle to root out Al-Qaeda from western Iraq during the 2005-2007 landmark surge campaign devised by General David Petraeus. The surge wheel has certainly turned around in favor of Al-Qaeda. Iraq's military downfall is the worst it has suffered since the U.S. invasion of the country in 2003, and Al-Qaeda's greatest Middle East battlefield triumph, following which its commander al-Baghdadi has vowed to proclaim the Middle East caliphate stretching between western Iraq and eastern Syria. This development has many troubling ramifications. There is no military force in the region capable of going into Iraq and stopping Al-Qaeda's advance, which was allowed to happen in consequence of the U.S. Army's precipitate exit from the country 3 years ago. Al-Qaeda's fortunes in Syria, Lebanon, and Egypt's Sinai Peninsula have received a major boost. The Sinai affiliates in particular are in close touch with al-Baghdadi. Of course, al-Baghdadi is the leader of ISIS, the al-Nusra Front there in Syria. Is the one that we need to be concerned with there presently. And we'll do a little housekeeping here on the Jesus Factor, get our tags all updated appropriately. Stand by. We'll finish up our segment on the Middle East and move in to the National Security Agency's surveillance operations against Americans in just a few moments. All right, I trust that that has taken care of the housekeeping, and my hope is the encoder going down is in fact behind us here now, and as I look on to the messages here on the chat, I trust that the tags here will update momentarily. Once we get that underway, okay, we're in good shape then. And on we go. All right, so in finishing up this update on the issues in the Middle East with Al-Qaeda and their forces' goal of creating a caliphate, which is essentially an Arab nation, remember, these jihadists are looking to redraw the world with their agenda being the world power, their religious agenda, their spiritual agenda, their legal platform. All right, all of these factors are in flux as no geographic location presently exists for the jihadist to stage their continuing military endeavors or to coalesce in a way that they can form a social and political machine that will fuel those military endeavors. So this is an important effort that Al-Qaeda has engaged in. It is one that has been on the back burner, but we have spoken about it numerous times here on the Jesus Factor. You won't hear this on the ABC Nightly News. The hookup between all of these forces that are arrayed from the Sinai all the way across Syria and into Iraq exacerbates the terrorist threat hanging over Israel, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. The Nusra Front, Al-Qaeda's Syrian affiliate, has acquired strategic depth in Iraq. Its leader, Abu Muhammad al-Julani, is expected to announce that his movement will join the new Islamist State. A merger of the Iraqi and Syrian Al-Qaeda branches could draw in a host of sympathetic Middle East Islamic groups. The ISIS victory in Iraq represents a humiliating setback for Tehran, which heavily backed the Iraqi army offensive led by its pro-Iranian Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki for cleansing the country of the violent Al-Qaeda presence. The U.S., by its decision to send weapons to the Iraqi army for its engagement with Al-Qaeda, was shown to have backed the losing side. The Iraqi army used up all its reserves for this offensive. Its only remaining option now is to fall back to Baghdad and regroup for the defense of the capital. This could mean a huge Arab nation or an Arab alliance stretching from Syria all the way across to Iraq should Baghdad eventually fall. Now, in the background of all this, you have an ongoing negotiation between the Palestinians and Israel that's being brokered by the United States. And the kinds of arrangements, as usual, that the United States is seeking to cram down Israel's throat are arrangements that clearly favor the Palestinians and Israel's withdrawal from settlements that they have established because of their strategic value. State Department spokesman Mary Harf said in Washington on the 31st of December of 2013 that Secretary John Kerry would discuss with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian Authority Chairman Mahmoud Abbas a proposed framework to serve as a guideline for addressing all the core issues in the decades-long dispute. Some people say this would be an interim agreement. No, that's not the case, she said. The core issues she listed were borders between Israel and a future Palestine, security arrangements, the fate of Palestinian refugees, and conflicting claims to the holy city of Jerusalem. Kerry leaves for Israel and Ramallah on New Year's Day to continue his shuttle. After Monday night, December 30th, Israel released from jail 26 Palestinian terrorists serving life sentences for murder. We had reported earlier that the U.S. Secretary does not expect Israel and Palestinian leaders to approve the proposed framework, only to contribute their comments. It's also been reported that Abbas had indicated to the Secretary that the Palestinians were preparing to reject his proposals by demanding their referral to the various pan-Arab forums. All right, and we've talked at length about the various amendments that had been considered. Much of what's going on here draws on the proposal of Ehud Olmert, the Prime Minister, back in 2008, which he never accepted and it was never approved by the Israeli authority. What they're looking for is for Israel to annex 6.8% of the West Bank, including the four main settlement blocks of Gush Etzion with Ephrata, Me'al, Adumim, Givat, Ziv, and Ariel, as well as all of the settlements of East Jerusalem and Har Homa, in exchange for the equivalent of 5.5% of Israeli territory. They also want to establish safe passage, a territorial link between the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, which would cut through southern Israel and remain under Israeli sovereignty, but Palestinian control. What we are hearing is that of all other options, American sponsors of the accord want to build an express railway from Gaza to Hebron without stops, which would be paid for by Washington. Go figure. Abbas has already informed John Kerry that he wants the train to go all the way to Ramallah. There will be a special road connecting Bethlehem with Ramallah that bypasses East Jerusalem. This is most likely the same route currently planned to go around Me'el Adumim. Since the safe passage will cross through Israeli territory, accounting for 1% of its territory, this area will be deducted from the land Israel concedes, leaving 4.54% of the land swap with the Palestinians. With regard to Jerusalem, East Jerusalem would be divided territorially along the lines of the Clinton parameters, with the exception of the Holy Basin, which compromises 0.04% of the West Bank. Sovereignty over this ancient heart of Jerusalem, with its unique and historic concentration of Jewish, Christian, and Muslim shrines, will pass to an international commission comprised of the U.S., Israel, the Palestinians, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. All right. All of these tenants, among a few others, are on the table being considered as Kerry continues his shuttle diplomacy between the Palestinian political party and Israel. And most of it is rehashed from the 2008 accord that had been rejected by Israel in that era. So we do not expect Israel to agree or go along with this. And as the continued shuffling of power across the Middle East unfolds, we will make that because, not because we think it's important, but because we believe the Lord has shown, in accordance with his word, that this geography is important to him. And we do believe as well that by two witnesses is anything established, history shows, as God's word declares, that this area is a key and central area. These people, the Israelis, are important to the Lord. So we will continue to monitor activities in that region on the Jesus Factor on the Eagle Radio Network. Stay tuned for an update on United States surveillance of her own citizens here on the Jesus Factor. liar, liar, as we move into news of the Obama administration's continuing efforts to spy on Americans. You know, we spoke a little bit about this as we traveled around the country. It was amazing to me how many people are utterly disgusted with the abomination of Obamacare. How many people have a clear understanding of the disaster it is for the United States. I wonder, in lieu of all of that, whether or not the last election was rigged. It certainly seems that there are enough people, at least now, that realize that this administration's agenda is one of destruction to the freedom of the people of the United States, and on an international level, one that we cover in the Israel update, the destruction of our preeminence as a world power. This is a two-pronged assault on the blessings of this nation. Being a preeminent world power is important because there is so much more evil in the world than that which this nation has done. And in a worldly sense, there's never been a nation in history that's had the capacity to do as much damage to others as this country has. And in many cases, and I am not here seeking to justify the United States in their activities, but in many cases, faced with the decision to either take over or dominate a country, particularly in the aftermath of World War II, this nation used its resources to rebuild. And it seems to me, had the outcome of that conflagration been different, and a guy like Adolf Hitler had been at the helm, the world would have been left in ruins, and people would have been enslaved by the millions. He was already well on his way to accomplishing those goals. And again, this is not to justify America, but to point out in the rainbow of wickedness that's out here in the world, the United States is certainly not the most wicked nation that could accomplish or retain preeminence on the international stage. Meanwhile, here at home, Rand Paul is leading a class action lawsuit with hundreds of thousands of Americans against President Barack Obama's National Security Agency over its spying on the American people. Senator Paul will be discussing the lawsuit in an exclusive appearance on Fox News. That took place this last Friday night, and we've learned that Paul will file a class action suit soon in the D.C. District Court, and that he will be filing it as an individual, not as a U.S. Senator. For a U.S. Senator to file such a class action lawsuit against the President of the United States would be extremely rare. This lawsuit allows the American people to join together in a grassroots manner against President Obama's NSA with a sitting U.S. Senator at the helm. Two prior class action lawsuits were filed in June. Classes have not yet been certified in those cases. The focus of the lawsuit will be how the NSA's actions violate the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. The lawsuit will target the NSA's metadata program. In case you don't understand how this works, it used to be, and I remember saying this 10 or 12 years ago, there aren't enough people to monitor everyone in the United States. They can't surveil everybody. Well, now, with the advent of huge servers sprawled across various states in these United States, they have databases that are large enough so they can accumulate data on every citizen, on every internet transaction, on everything that's said and done on the internet by every citizen, by every person who takes part in internet activity. Now, it may not be necessary for an individual to look at that data today, but if you should stumble across or run afoul of a law promulgated by these people, whether it be a law having to do with your motor vehicle, your payment of taxes, your use of one drug or another. Perhaps you forgot to pay your local taxes. Even the most minor infraction can lead to an investigation and the authorization for these authorities to review the data that has been accumulated in these massive databases. And what was impossible 10 years ago, essentially the monitoring of each and every person in these United States, all of their electronic activities particularly, and some of their more private activities as well, through those electronic activities, joined with what has been promulgated as law in Obamacare, just about everything you have done or will do can be unearthed in the event you should trip over one of the regulations or laws established by the almost endless, in an almost endless chain coming out of both Washington, D.C. and our state legislatures. So this lawsuit is being moved with the idea of shutting down the gathering of such information by the government. And, of course, the Fourth Amendment, that amendment that deals with the right of individuals to be secure in their private papers, in their activities, is the focal point of the lawsuit. And if you go to Rand Paul's campaign website, you'll find that more than 300,000 Americans have already indicated they will sign up for the suit when it is actually filed in D.C. District Court. Americans can join the lawsuit by visiting Paul's website. The class action suit from Senator Paul against the president comes on the heels of two different conflicting court rulings in individual suits against the NSA, with one court ruling that the NSA was within its bounds to spy on Americans shortly after a different court ruled the NSA's actions were unconstitutional. The conflicting decisions all but guarantee an eventual Supreme Court-level case on the matter. Excuse me. Now, if you're interested in how they've decided that this is okay for this surveillance to continue, these series of articles coming from the Washington Times, by the way, almost Orwellian is the headline. And that is the description a federal judge gave earlier this week to the massive spying by the National Security Agency, that is NSA, on virtually all 380 million cell phones in the United States. In the first meaningful and jurisdictionally grounded judicial review of the NSA cell phone spying program, U.S. District Court Judge Richard Leon, a George W. Bush appointee sitting in Washington, D.C., ruled that the scheme of asking a secret judge on a secret court for a general warrant to spy on all American cell phone users without providing evidence of probable cause of criminal behavior against any of them is unconstitutional because it directly violates the Fourth Amendment. Thank you, Steve. That is up there on the chat. Those who would review the Fourth Amendment in all of its grandeur. And readers of this page are familiar with the purpose of that amendment and requirements it imposes on the government. The framers intended it to prevent the new government in America from doing to Americans what the British government had done to the colonists under the king. The British government had used general warrants, which are not based on individual probable cause and do not name the place to be searched or the person or thing to be seized, to authorize British soldiers to search the colonists wherever they pleased for whatever they wished to seize. The reason for the Fourth Amendment requirement of individualized probable cause and specificity in the warrant is to prevent the very type of general warrant that the NSA has claimed is lawful. The reason for preventing general warrants is that they have, in past circumstances, become instruments of tyranny. It is against this well-known historical context that Judge Leon engaged in his analysis of the feds who spy on us. This is truly the first jurisdictionally based judicial ruling on the cell phone aspect of the domestic spying that former NSA contractor Edward Snowden revealed last spring. Though the NSA and the Obama and Bush administrations have claimed that judges of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, we're going to talk about this operation in just a few moments. We're running a little short on time, but I want to get to this because this is the crux of all of this is that the court that has authorized this surveillance is the kind of star chamber affair that any American in the 17 and 1800s would have massed and armed revolts against. All right, now, and we will go to that in just a moment. So you have this multinational court, and in the ruling that we've recently had here, the judge dispatched with clarity the government's argument that two Supreme Court cases from the late 70s and 80s in which the court permitted evidence obtained from telephone billing data without a search warrant to be introduced in criminal cases support the constitutionality of the NSA's phone metadata collection. That was before the era of cell phones, and that was before the Supreme Court ruled that a search warrant is required to hunt electronically for marijuana plants in a home and to install and follow a GPS device in a car. By ruling that two now outdated Supreme Court cases are no longer controlling, he almost guaranteed that the High Court will take this case. The NSA was emasculated before Judge Leon. Gone were the lies of Director of the National Intelligence James Clapper, who stated under oath that the government does not spy on Americans. Gone was the bravado of NSA boss General Keith Alexander, who claimed initially under oath that his spies stopped 52 terrorist plots, and then mysteriously corrected himself and said they really stopped just three, but then declined to identify the three. Gone was the "if we don't do this, we will all die" argument. Gone was the "if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear" nonsense that congressional NSA apologists have advanced. In place of the political claptrap is the court's finding that not only is the NSA spying unconstitutional, but it doesn't work. After hearing the NSA state its case, Judge Leon wrote, "I have serious doubts about the efficacy of the metadata collection program as a means of conducting time-sensitive investigations in cases involving imminent threats of terrorism." He added an admonition that it doesn't help the NSA's case to be less than candid with the judge. All right, so that is the crux of that case. Now, the secret court that oversees the nation's intelligence activities, in the background of all of this, renewed its approval of the National Security Agency's telephone records program last Friday, granting the government a new 3-month window to collect data on all Americans. Director of the National Intelligence James Clapper's office announced the court's rulings in a statement, though officials didn't make the ruling itself public, saying it was going through declassification procedures. The decision marks the 36th time the program has been approved by the Secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. Now, this particular court is essentially has subverted the other rulings, and it is one of the reasons why this case will end up in the Supreme Court. In the administration's view, consistent with the recent holdings of the United States District Courts for the Southern District of New York and Southern District of California, as well as the findings of 15 judges of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, on 36 separate occasions over the past 7 years that the telephony metadata collection program is lawful. Sean Turner, spokesman for Mr. Clapper, said, last month, all right, and this is the case that we were talking about, last month, the ruling came through that the records program was unconstitutional. Leon was the guy who ruled against it. In his statement on Friday, Mr. Turner said the Obama administration is willing to consider changes to the program while still maintaining its operational benefits. Under the NSA program, the agency collects the time, duration, and parties involved in most calls placed within the United States. The agency stores that data for 5 years, but says it doesn't query the data unless it is investigating a specific terrorism case. When it delves into the data to see who a suspect is calling, who those associates are calling, and who that second round of associates is calling. See, this goes out. It's a daisy chain. So chances of you and three of your calls removed somehow or another being in contact with someone who might be associated with one of these cases, thus triggering an investigation of your private phone calls, is not entirely unlikely. All right, now, again, this particular court, this national, international court, is one that, again, was classed as almost Orwellian. And we're going to do a little bit further investigation on this particular court because where they're coming from and why they believe that they have authority over American citizens to shovel the Constitution out the door, it will make for interesting Jesus Factor review, and we will make that a more detailed part of next week's broadcast. We will be following, Lord willing, the endeavors of the Obama administration as they continue to use every opportunity to look into the personal habits and business of the American people, and at the same time subvert our authority as a national, international force around the world. Just a devastating two-pronged assault on the United States. And interestingly enough, in response to the current state, many people, you know, there's a program out there that's called Preppers. Many of you, I'm sure, have seen the program Preppers. Well, as it turns out, there is a rather high-profile guy by the name of Roscoe Bartlett, who was a congressman down there in Washington. One of the things that he talked about all the time when he was in Washington was that he was afraid that somehow the infrastructure, the electric grid, and all of our electronic capabilities here in the United States could be easily overthrown or devastated, damaged by a terrorist attack. When he was in Congress, he latched onto an apocalyptic issue, one almost no one else had ever seemed to talk about, America's dangerously vulnerable power grid. In speech after late night speech on the House floor, Bartlett hectored the nearly empty chamber. If the United States doesn't do something to protect the grid, and soon, a terrorist or an act of nature will put an end to life as we know it. Well, Mr. Bartlett has become a prepper. And we have a report on his operations. He set up a out-of-the-way place in a one-paved driveway that runs off a narrow, rocky dirt road, 4,000 feet, one of the highest U.S. elevations east of the Rocky Mountains. No cell phone service. The nearest shopping mall is an hour's drive away. When he arrived, and this reporter arrived, Bartlett greeted him in faded denim overalls and an unruly white beard and asked if anything had happened since he was last in Maryland about a week earlier. I told him that the National Security Agency had just been caught tapping into the connections between data centers run by Google and Yahoo. He looked nonplussed, limiting the role of government, consumed much of his life for the 20 years he spent in Congress, leaving little time to simply sit by his lake and watch the sun go down. Bartlett says that he was asked by this reporter why he was building this thing, and he doesn't need any reason to justify, he told them, getting far away from the hustle and stress of Capitol Hill. Bartlett's newest cabin overlooks his man-made lake and will become his primary residence after he finishes the interior. He works on the cabin 6 days a week. And the pictures of this place, which we are not able to show you here on the Jesus Factor, include a huge array of solar panels, a number of different pieces of equipment that one would find in someone's array of things that they were using if they believed that a disaster could or would overtake the United States at some future time. And we've all seen, on an individual basis and as a group, we've seen that it makes some sense to not be too dependent on the wiles of the American modern structure in a world that seems so delicately poised on disaster. And so I thought it appropriate to bring up Roscoe Bartlett, who was always a strong voice for independent thinkers and personal liberty when he was on Capitol Hill as a congressman. He is now a consultant for a firm seeking to protect its data from the surveillance of the NSA, and he is spending the great majority of his time and the money that he's accumulated in his life building a survival outpost. And go figure how the wheels turn. And we certainly have enjoyed being with you here on the Jesus Factor. We look forward, Lord willing, to joining you again next week, and hope that may the Lord bless all, each and every one of you, and thank those of you who stuck around. And again, we hope to see you next week and look forward to seeing you over the course of the week online. May the Lord bless you all, and thanks for listening.